Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
All right, I'm a couple minutes late starting. Gladys said that she still wants her money's worth. I said that I would take it off my time. Tom said it will count against my time. So I have a question for those of you who are here in the room. I will ask you collectively, where did everybody go?
They think you're worn out.
That's what it is. They think I'm worn out. I'm like the Energizer Bunny thing. I must keep going. But I got so used to all the internet folks being here. That was so enjoyable having them around. And then I blinked and they were gone. It was such a good weekend. It was so enjoyable. I have two different topics, completely divergent things, that I wanted to address tonight. So I had to decide which one. We were either going to continue in 1 Samuel, or I wanted to talk a little bit about a question that was asked on Facebook today about Passover and Easter and their calendrical connections. And so I was going to answer that question, and I couldn't decide which one to do, and so I landed on both. There was a question on Facebook today, which is a good question and a fair question and a question that deserves an answer. One of the GCA folk asked, since we do observe the communion service once a year, and I am firmly convinced that that's the only schedule that you can find that can be defended biblically, and so that's fine. They're okay with that. It's once a year. But then we do it on the Sunday that is on our calendar, Easter Sunday. We get together and have the communion. And so their question was, well, if it was established at Passover, then why not on Passover, wherever Passover falls each year? If we're really going to be New Testament-like, if we're really going to be specific, if we're really driving home the point that it is intrinsically connected to the Passover feast, then why aren't we keeping it on Passover, considering that Passover and Easter actually sometimes, this year, Easter and Passover were neck and neck, right behind each other. Passover was Friday, Easter was Sunday, and I'm going to keep using the word Easter just because that's the calendar date I'm referring to. But sometimes, as in years past, sometimes Passover and Easter Sunday can be separated by a matter of weeks. And so their question was, why don't we, even if we're going to do it on a Sunday, why isn't it the Sunday after Passover every year? Or even better yet, why isn't it Passover? That was the question. And it's a really good question. It's a fair question. The glib answer is because we're Gentiles. But there's so much more to it. So I want to discuss the calendar history of the Passover-Easter debate, because the debate about when the celebration of both the Lord's Supper and the resurrection should be celebrated, that debate began as early as 120 AD. And so we are part of a very long-standing debate. This is not something that GCA said, let's do this once a year, and then we created a whole new conundrum. This is a problem that's been around for a long time because our calendar keeps changing. Some of the information that I want to bring you tonight, I lifted from the website Answers in Genesis. They wrote a series of articles recently answering the question of whether Easter itself is pagan. And they tried to kind of take a middle line. They took a very fair middle line on it. And the first part of the articles kind of say, well, the establishment of the day of Easter was not directly connected to pagan worship holidays necessarily. It was a calendrical choice, as I'm going to show you tonight. But then they also admit that the festival itself happened in a month that was named after the goddess, and that's why the spring festival existed, and that there were rabbits and baby chicks and bunny, you know, all that, because it was a spring fertility feast. So their answer was kind of, well, yes and no. So some of this information I'm bringing you is from their website, to be fair. First off, have you ever heard of Schaff's History of the Christian Church? Are you familiar with that? Philip and David Schaff, S-C-H-A-F-F. They actually discuss the origin of the date and the customs of the resurrection celebration. And they give us a good piece to begin this discussion about the date. They write, "The Christian Passover naturally grew out of the Jewish Passover as the Lord's Day grew out of the Sabbath, the Paschal Lamb being regarded as a prophetic type of Christ, the Lamb slain for our sins. And the deliverance from bondage of Egypt was a type of the redemption from sin. And it's certainly the oldest and most important annual festival of the church and can be traced back to the first century, or at all events, to the middle of the second, when it was universally observed, though with a difference as to the day and to the extent of the fast that was connected with it." The point there is that the early church kept the Passover. And we certainly see that when Paul is writing to the Corinthian church. Somebody look up. Go ahead and do it. Let's just look at that. 1 Corinthians 5. We'll just all go there. 1 Corinthians 5. The Corinthian church, as I mentioned repeatedly when I was teaching on yearly Lord's Supper a couple of years ago, and that teaching is on our website, I gave evidence that the church at Corinth was a mixture of Jews and Gentiles. And of course, you know that Paul always made those distinctions. He was very clear about the fact that if you were Jewish and a Christian, it was still okay to be circumcised, the same way that he circumcised Timothy before he took him into the temple. But when dealing with Titus, who was a Gentile, he wouldn't allow Titus to be circumcised because he was not a descendant of Abraham, and circumcision was a sign of the Abrahamic covenant. And when Paul was among Gentiles, he was very clear to say that they had no part in the law and that they could not be justified by the law, that they should not think that they could be in any way sanctified or justified by the law, or else they had fallen from grace and Christ was no help to them. And yet, we read in the book of Acts that when he was in Jerusalem, James said, "You see all these Jewish brethren here who love Christ and are zealous for the law. And so you need to show them that you're not against Moses." And so when among the Jews, Paul shaved his head and took a vow and sacrificed an animal and did these things among the Jews that he would never do among the Gentiles, things that he told the Gentiles don't ever do this, he would do among the Jews because there really was this kind of distinction. Well, the Passover celebration for 1400 years had been an Israelite Jewish feast that was to be perpetuated throughout the generations of Israel. And so Paul did not say, "Okay, now Christ has come and resurrected, so stop that." He continued to say exactly what Christ said, which was, keep doing it, but now think of Christ. Now just change the focus. And so when writing to the Corinthian church in chapter 5, he's actually discussing in chapter 5 the fact that there's a real problem in their church, which is that there's one among them who is so involved in sexual sin that the crime has to be addressed by the church. And so Paul's really writing about that. So in verse 5, he says, "I've decided to deliver such a one to Satan for the destruction of his flesh, that his spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord Jesus. Your boasting is not good." And then he says, "Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump?" That's a Hebraism that's been around a lot. You see it a couple times in the Bible. The concept being that if you put a little bit of yeast into some dough, it raises the whole lump of dough. And you can even take a little piece of that lump of dough off and set it aside, and it'll continue to rise, and a piece off that, and it'll continue to rise. And so his point is, if you have somebody in your church body who is involved in this kind of promiscuity, they were having sex with their father's wife, that may have been their own mother, or it may have been a stepmother. In any case, it was a really bad sin, and he said to have him even in your midst affects the whole body, because a little leaven leavens the whole of the lump. So then, verse 7, very interesting language, clean out the old leaven. As soon as he says that, it immediately harkens back to the Feast of Unleavened Bread, during which the Jews would clean all the leaven out of their homes and out of the community of Israel. So he says, clean out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, just as you are, in fact, unleavened. In other words, get the sin out of your church because you are the body of Christ, and therefore you're to be a sinless body, an unleavened body, leaven being the type of sin, so get it out of your church. For Christ, our Passover, has also been sacrificed. So now he's made a direct reference to both Jews and Gentiles, to Christ being the Passover lamb, and follows that with, let us therefore celebrate the feast. What feast? Well, the Passover feast, the unleavened bread feast, but not to do it with the old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So he gives a spiritual application to the idea of leaven and unleavened bread, leaven being a type of sin, drive that leaven out, be an unleavened body, but then celebrate the feast, not with the old leaven, which is leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. And as you know from what we read out of chapter 11 on this past Sunday morning, he then gives them instructions about how to properly take the Lord's Supper. And so this is all in the context of a single letter he's writing to them, which may have been affected by the season of year in which he was writing it, but he makes several references to the Passover, Christ the Passover, leaven, keep the feast, unleaven, be unleavened, and this is how you properly take the Lord's Supper. So there's all these connections to the Church of Jews and Gentiles.
And they have a new sacrifice, Christ the new sacrifice, the new lamb.
Exactly. So he becomes the Passover lamb.
He's new. This is a new
exactly.
Sacrifice.
Right. And yet there seems to be a continuity to the Passover itself. He doesn't say, quit doing it. Instead, he puts Christ at the center of it and makes that the inspiration for it. So he readjusts the typology, the symbology, the purpose and meaning, but he doesn't say stop doing it as a consequence. The early church, you know, trace back to the first century, at least the middle of the second, the Passover was still universally observed, according to Philip Schaff in his book. So it appears clear from the earliest writings of the church fathers that the resurrection was almost universally celebrated by the church, and there were, however, differences in the manner and the date of the celebration. Fasting and feasting accompanied the remembrance of the date, but when to stop the fasting and begin the feasting was often disputed. The date question fell into two camps. Number one, should the celebration be held on the day of the resurrection or on the date of the Jewish Passover? Because you've got the Church of Jews and Gentiles. And so you know from the book of Acts that right away the church began meeting on the first day of the week. And it's because Christ resurrected on the first day of the week. But you've also got the Jews who are continuing to keep the Passover, and even Paul advocates that when he writes to the Corinthian church. So between those two groups, of course, there's going to be a certain amount of debate about what's proper here. Should we fast up until the first day of the week and then feast? Or should we fast up until the Lord's Supper and then feast? And that debate goes a long way back. And that is essentially the question that's before us right now. Somebody's asking, should we be doing this on Passover Day, or should we be taking the Lord's Supper and recognizing his death and resurrection on the Sunday following, or the Sunday closest? In Asia Minor, there was a group of churches that claimed that the apostles John and Philip appointed Nisan 14th as the date of the celebration. And this group became known as the Quartodecimans, from the Latin for 14. Because they supposed that the celebration should begin at the time when the disciples ate the Passover meal with Christ in the upper room. So there's that defense. The celebration should begin on the 14th, probably in the evening, when Christ was in the upper room and established that final Passover and directed it toward himself. There was the group that said, that's the date at which you start recognizing the feast. It should be on the 14th. And that group claimed that the apostles John and Philip had necessarily said that Nisan 14th was the day to go with. The date of Nisan 14th had been prescribed because God instituted the Passover meal and the Feast of Unleavened Bread upon the Exodus from Egypt on that day, Nisan 14th. This was the first month of the Hebrew calendar. The month would have begun on the new moon, and the 14th day would have been marked by the full moon. Unlike our current calendar, which begins shortly after the first part of winter, this new moon month, was the beginning of spring and had formerly been called the month of Abib back in Exodus. So, Irenaeus, who died right around 202, so we're very early in church history here, recorded an account from Polycarp, who lived from AD 70 to 155. And Polycarp was the bishop of Smyrna and a disciple of the Apostle John. Irenaeus tells of Polycarp's visit to Rome, where he discussed the issue with a fellow named Anicetus, who was the bishop of Rome. The controversy was not merely as regards the day, but also as regards the form itself of the observance. For some consider themselves bound to fast on one day, and others 2 days. Still others, he wrote, do so for 40 days. And the diurnal and the nocturnal hours they measure out together as their fasting days. As this variety among the observers had not its origin in our time, but long before in that of our predecessors, and yet nevertheless all these lived in peace one with another, and we also keep peace together. For neither could Anicetus persuade Polycarp to forego the observance in his own way, inasmuch as these things had been also so observed by John the disciple of our Lord, and by other apostles with whom he had been conversant. Nor, on the other hand, could Polycarp succeed in persuading Anicetus to keep the observance in his way, for he maintained that he was bound to adhere to the usage of the presbyters who preceded him. And in this state of affairs, they held fellowship with one another. So what you've really got going here is very, very early on. You've got the group in Rome doing it one way, and then you've got the Jerusalem group doing it another way, and you've got Polycarp in the middle, who's a disciple of John's, who goes to Rome and says, well, it needs to be the 14th, and he says, well, we're doing the first day of the week. And neither one could convince the other. The point of all that history is to say this is not new or unique to GCA. This is an ongoing discussion, and there are good arguments to be made either way. Polycarp understood from the Apostle John that the celebration was to be observed from the date of Nisan 14th, while the tradition in the Western Church was to celebrate on the Sunday following the Passover. This difference did not lead them to break fellowship, but to honor one another and continue with their practices in their respective regions. Other early church fathers who sided with Polycarp included Eusebius, Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, and Tertullian. Clearly, as early as the bishopric of Sixtus I in Rome, which is AD 114 to 128, there was a difference in the date of the celebration. The Western church tradition, even as early as AD 150, according to the account of Polycarp above, was to break the fast on the Sunday following the Jewish Passover, since this was the first day of the week when Christ arose from the tomb. And this was the dominant view in the church at this point, and found its support in the fact that the celebration was in observance of the resurrection. Since Christ rose from the tomb on Sunday, according to Luke 24:1, the fast was broken and the celebratory feast began on Sunday. The contention over the date of the celebration was basically between a small group in the East and the majority in the West. Now, do you understand that? That means that the majority of the group was doing the Sunday worship. But then there was the smaller group in the East arguing for the Nisan 14th date. However, this was not seen as an issue of orthodoxy until Victor I threatened excommunication of the Quartodecimans around AD 195, a threat he later abandoned at the advice of several synods. As is always the case, there's always someone who rises up and says, we're right, and that's it, and you do it our way, and you don't have any options, and so that happens. So move forward to AD 325, Council of Nicaea. The issue was finally settled by the church as a whole, The desire of the churches as a whole, even prior to the council, was to unite the entire body of Christ on this all-important day of celebrating the resurrection. It seems that one of the major issues of contention was that the celebration of the Jewish Passover had slipped to a period before the vernal or spring equinox. Okay, now this is important because the Jewish calendar, as you know, the Hebrew calendar is 12 months of 30 days. It's 360 days. And as a consequence, every 6 years, they would add an additional month of 30 days that would bring the calendar back around. And that's why Passover keeps moving on our calendar every year. Every year, Passover gets earlier, 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 and then jumps to the end of April again, and then it goes back, back, back.
Does their calendar begin on a different day every year? Like
yes, because it's a lunar calendar. It's not like ours. It's a lunar calendar based on the cycles of the moon. We're on a solar calendar based on the cycle of the sun, actually based on the rotation of the earth around the sun. So we, every 4 years, have to add an extra day to make up for the fact that 365 and a quarter days make up a year. And so every 4 years we get a leap year and we throw in an extra day to bring our calendar around. So it's the difference between the lunar calendar, which is how they're determining when Passover is, versus the solar calendar. Now here's the religious argument. It's clear that Nisan was the first month of their year and it was in the spring. And so since it was a spring month when Jesus died, the dating of Easter, we're just going to keep using that word, started moving so far backwards that every once in a while it would end up being before the spring equinox. So it was technically in winter, and so the Western Church argued to be accurate, if we're really going to look at when Jesus resurrected, it has to be sometime in the spring. It can't be back there in the winter anywhere, even if the Jewish calendar moves Passover back there. And that's why a couple of years ago you had that couple of week difference between Passover and Easter, because Easter on our solar calendar is now determined based on the first full moon after the spring equinox, so that it always happens in the spring.
Say that again.
The council determined the date should be fixed to the first Sunday following the first full moon after the vernal equinox. So once it's spring, then there's going to be a new moon, then there's going to be a full moon. And what they're basing that on, they're basing that on Nisan 14th. The month of Nisan started at a new moon. So the 14th of the month would have been a full moon, and that would have been the weekend when Jesus died and resurrected. And so they're saying, the spring equinox, go to the first full moon after the spring equinox. That following Sunday, they designate it as Easter. Meanwhile, you've got the Jews who are saying, but we're going to stick to the lunar calendar, and Passover is going to be determined by the lunar calendar, and as a consequence, their first month gets earlier, 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 and then they add their month, and it runs late again, and it gets earlier, earlier, earlier. So that movement, if they had simply kept Easter, I'm going to keep using that term, if they had just connected Easter to always the first Sunday after Passover, that would have sometimes put Easter at the end of winter instead of in the early spring. And that was the argument of the Council of Nicaea that caused them to say, well, then we need to establish a time when Easter's celebrated. Got all that? Yeah, I know. I know. Tim went, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. It seems that one of the major issues of contention was that the celebration of the Jewish Passover had slipped to a period before the vernal equinox. To ensure that the celebration did not continue to drift backward in time, the council members desired a date after the equinox. Thus, the council determined that the date should be fixed to the first Sunday following the full moon after the vernal equinox. The Sunday observance was agreed upon by all, and it replaced the observance that was on Nisan 14th by the minority in the Eastern Church. This date, then, of the first Sunday after the first full moon after the vernal equinox, then aligned to the Jewish date of Passover without being directly tied to it. The month of Nisan, is a spring month and should rightly fall after the vernal equinox within a solar year. Thus, Christ's resurrection was in the spring. Knowing the moon has a 28-day cycle and that the full moon would be comparable to the 14th day since the Jewish month began on the new moon, so the Sunday following this full moon would approximate the day of the resurrection, which would then become the focus of the feast. The Easter celebration was assigned a date to correspond with the Jewish Passover, but was not necessarily tied to its date. With this calculation, the date of Easter becomes a movable date that may fall anywhere between March 22nd and April 25th on our current calendar, but it's always in the spring. Got that?
Because spring always starts on March 21st.
On a solar calendar, that is the vernal equinox. I mean, my birthday, September 21st, is the first day of fall. And so...
fall equinox.
Yeah, and so on our solar calendar, that's where spring starts. And so...
you were saying this, and I was thinking a couple of years back, it landed on March 23rd, and that was about the earliest I could ever remember it landing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're explaining, and I'm thinking, boy, a lot happened that week.
Yeah, it was...
spring equinox, full moon.
Yeah. And of course, because it's not connected to the cycle of the moon, that can happen. So you've got these two different calendars at work
against each other. It's not actually tied to, or it's not actually calculated when we celebrate. It's not actually calculated and in line with Passover then.
Not directly, even though it's connected to it based on trying to get as close an approximation of the proper spring Sunday to celebrate the resurrection. And then you've got those folks who are saying, but it's about the Passover, and so they're going to follow the lunar calendar and try to approximate the best day for that. So you've got the two groups, you've got the two camps, and hence the...
Westerners are always trying to tell people how to east-west.
Exactly, hence the debate. So even after the unifying efforts of the Council of Nicaea, the actual date on which the resurrection was celebrated continued to vary, no surprise there. Disputes remained about which astronomical cycle would be used and on which day the equinox fell. Kind of what you just brought up. The Romans held that March 21st was the day of the equinox, while the Alexandrians set the date as March 18th. Also, some churches would not celebrate on the Sunday following the full moon. So, though minor disputes continued, the dates for Easter in the Roman Church were set in tables followed by the majority of the churches. And then there is another discrepancy that we have between then and now, which is that our calendar changed. There is an 84-year sun-moon cycle for calculating the two celebrations, Nisan 14 versus when Easter would fall after the full moon of the spring equinox. That was an 84-year sun-moon cycle that was then changed to a 19-year cycle when the Gregorian calendar replaced the Julian calendar in 1582. So you hear me every once in a while say, if we're going to get real picky about date setting for things that happened in the first century, you're going to get lost because the calendars have changed and been adjusted so many times. Nothing we're really doing calendrically now has a direct correlation to what happened on those same dates of those same months back then. So we have to deal just in broad estimations, pretty much three-month periods, summer, winter, fall, spring, take your best shot. So follow this. Easter is calculated as the first Sunday after the Paschal full moon that occurs on or after the vernal equinox. If the full moon falls on a Sunday, then Easter is the following Sunday. The holiday can occur anywhere between March 22nd and April 25th. The Western Church does not use an actual or astronomically correct date for the vernal equinox, but instead a fixed date, March 21st. And by full moon, it does not mean the astronomical full moon, but the, quote, ecclesiastical moon, which is based on tables that were already created by the church. I know. Tim just put his head in his hands.
That's what I'm thinking, the same thing. I'm like, what?
Up until then.
You were tracking till that moment. Okay. These constructs allow the date of Easter to be calculated in advance rather than determined by actual astronomical observances, which are naturally less predictable. The Council of Nicaea in 325 established that Easter would be celebrated on Sundays. Before that, Easter was celebrated on different days in different places in the same year. The Orthodox Church, the Eastern Church, uses the same formula to calculate Easter, but bases the date on a slightly different calendar, the Julian calendar. So they stuck it out with the Julian calendar to calculate Easter. Didn't make the change to the Gregorian, the calendar that is most widely used today. Consequently, both churches only occasionally celebrate Easter on the same day. The Eastern Church and the Western Church sometimes have different Easters. Unlike the Western Church, the Eastern Church sets the date of Easter according to the actual astronomical full moon and the actual equinox as observed along the meridian of Jerusalem, which was the site of the crucifixion and the resurrection. So the argument can be made that they are in some ways more accurate. Now, I began by saying, the original question was, so then why do we observe the Lord's Supper not on the Passover, but instead on the day that corresponds with Easter? And there's a couple reasons for it. Turn to Romans 14 and the answer's there. The first answer to that question is everything I just read and the realization that despite efforts to unify the church around what day and in what way and in what manner the resurrection and the Passover should be celebrated and observed. Out of the 2,000 years, roughly, of the church, you've got 1,900 years of discussing and arguing and debating about it. The reason for that is that if you look at the Bible simply isn't specific about it. The Bible simply does not tell us. It doesn't lay out a standard and say, here is how the Gentile church should do it. And I keep using the word Gentile because it's specific. When Paul was among Jews, he did emphasize things like feasts and Sabbaths, and if they wanted to eat kosher, that was okay if that was according to their own conscience. And he did participate in Jewish sacrifice and vows in Jerusalem, while at the same time telling Gentiles in Galatia that if they did any of those kind of things, they had fallen from grace. Paul had a very clear Jew-Gentile distinction in his head. So I began with a glib response and said, well, we do it because we're Gentiles. Paul writing to a predominantly Gentile church in Rome, this church in Rome that celebrated more on Sunday than the Eastern church that went more toward Passover, that church, when he wrote to them, he wrote this. I'm in Romans 14. No, I'm not. I will be in a minute. And let me just say, since I made that statement, I have often argued that the church at Rome was also a mixture of Jews and Gentiles. But Paul makes it clear throughout the letter which group he's writing to. He talks about you that are circumcised, you that are Jews. He talks about the Gentiles don't boast against the natural branches. He understands the two groupings. And so in order to bring peace between the two groups, he finally comes to this conclusion. Verse 4. Now let's just start in verse 1, just so you get it. Except the one who is weak in faith, but not for the purpose of passing judgment on his opinions. In other words, he's trying to get them to just stop judging each other. You've got the Gentiles who are judging the Jews judging the Gentiles. The Gentiles saying, well, you're continuing to do these things that aren't necessary anymore. And the Jews are arguing, well, we're Abraham's seed, and so we do it and you don't, and therefore you're somehow lesser. Paul is saying, stop judging each other because, for instance, verse 2, one man has faith that he can eat all things, while the one who's weak eats vegetables only. Some would eat kosher, some wouldn't. Some would be able to eat meat sacrificed to idols, others couldn't. And so he said, these are matters of conscience. Stop judging each other over it. Let not him who eats regard with contempt him who does not eat. And let not him who does not eat judge him who eats, for God has accepted him. Who are you to judge the servant of someone else? To his own master he stands or falls, and stand he will, for the Lord is able to make him stand. One man, verse 5, this is why we're reading this, one man regards one day above another. Another regards every day alike. Let every man be fully convinced in his own mind. He who observes the day observes it for the Lord, and he who eats does so for the Lord, for he gives thanks to God. And he who eats not for the Lord, he does not eat, and he gives thanks to God. For not one of us lives for himself, and not one dies for himself. For if we live, we live for the Lord, and if we die, we die for the Lord. Therefore, whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. So in the midst of all that, he says, it's a matter of individual conscience now. One man celebrates one day, one man celebrates another day. Don't judge each other over these things. This is a place where we have that kind of Christian freedom and Christian conscience. So when it came to the question of when would we take the Lord's Supper, having become convinced that it was going to be a once a year thing, I wanted to do it close to Passover, but I also wanted to do it to celebrate the resurrection. And in order to do that, it seemed like the Sunday when the church celebrates the resurrection seemed like the proper day to do that. But that reaches back, like I said, back to the first century, that there were churches doing that and there were churches debating that. I could make the argument for the Passover, and some folks on Facebook have, and said, well, you know, there are churches in town that do Passover Seders, and it's really educational to attend those. And I've been to some, and they are very educational because you get a sense of what it was that Jesus did and what the cup of blessing was and how he took that piece of bread and set it aside till after the meal and how he brought that out and broke it. And so it helps you to understand the Jewish typology that was wrapped up in the Passover meal and how it is fulfilled in Christ, and how that Passover lamb spoke of Christ, and how the blood on the doorpost spoke of Christ. But I would never say that Gentile Christians must now keep the Passover meal, because Jesus did not institute the Passover meal. What he instituted was the Lord's Supper observance of the bread and wine. And so there are folks who said, well, would it be okay if we went to a Seder and learned about that? And my answer is yes. Is that what's in your conscience? Yes. If you do it to Christ. We're going to have our meeting on Passover. We're going to find out every year what the 14th of Nisan is, and that's where we're going to get together and have the Lord's Supper. Fine. If that's what your conscience is, fine. GCA has a history of doing it on the Sunday that is traditionally Easter, because that's the Sunday when most people can travel and come be with us, and it's part of our homecoming service, and it makes that weekend a really special weekend because we teach and we email and we Facebook all year long, but we get together in one common place once a year and remember the Lord in his death and in his resurrection, and so we do that on Resurrection Sunday. And that's our conscience, and that's fine. So that was a very long answer to a short question. But it was a good question, and it needed to be answered. All right?
Good sermon.
Okay, end of sermon one. Turn to 1 Samuel. Let's at least get one chapter down in 1 Samuel. Is that okay with you all? I mean, Gladys, you want to get your money's worth? You can stick around for that?
I'll do that.
Okay, good. We are in 1 Samuel chapter 7. Very, very familiar story. Very familiar theme, and it's going to kind of wrap up the first seven chapters of the book of 1 Samuel, which kind of act as a unit in and of themselves, because when you get to chapter 8, you are introduced to Israel telling Samuel that they want a king, and God taking that request as an act of rebellion and rejection of him, made even worse by the fact that when you're in chapter 7, they are under Philistine oppression and have been for many, many years. But typical of Israel, whenever they're under the oppression of one of their foreign enemies, when it finally gets bad enough, they cry out to God. And then God delivers them. And then everything's good again. And then they go back to their ways and back to chasing their gods and back to their rebellion. And so this time, instead of going after the Balaam and the Ashtaroth, instead of chasing the Canaanite gods they decide that they would like a king. So it's just a human that they're going to raise up and make leader over them. And as we'll see next week, when Samuel talks to God about it, God says, it's not you they've rejected. They're rejecting me. They don't want me ruling over them. And so the first six chapters of 1 Samuel have been kind of building up to that point, because the rest of 1 and 2 Samuel is really about Saul and David. So it's really about these first two kings of Israel and the contrast between them. The one that they wanted because he was a head taller than everybody else and he looked like a king to the rest of the world, and then the king that God chose, who was far, far different. So chapter 7, verse 1, you might recall, we've been looking at it last week, that the children of Israel went into battle, got beat bad against the Philistines. So then they decided what we should do is we should take the ark with us. So they took the ark with them. Not only did they get beat bad, but they lost the ark. Big mistake. So then the ark was placed in front of Dagon. Dagon fell down. They propped him up. Dagon fell down again. His head and his hands came off. And so they decided, well, we just won't walk where that happened. That solves that problem. And so then God put boils on them and mice in their fields and sickness and death. And so they got rid of it, put it on an ox cart, put a couple of milk cows in front of the ox cart, and the milk cows took it right back to Israel. And Israel, foolishly, as soon as it arrived there, the people in Beth Shemesh decided that, we should go look at it. Let's find out what we got here. Let's lift the lid and see what's in the box. It's like a gift. And 50,070 men were struck dead. And that takes us to chapter 7, verse 1. The very end of the previous chapter said, they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath-Jearim, saying, the Philistines have brought back the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to you. And the men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took the ark of the Lord and brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill, and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to keep the ark of the Lord. And it came about from the day that the ark remained at Kiriath-Jearim that it was a long time, for it was 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. Some of your other translations will say, sought after or cried after the Lord. Okay, because as long as there's no ark, there's no Day of Atonement. There's nothing going on in the holiest place. The ark has been several years among the Philistines. Now, for 20 years, it's just sitting in a house in Kiriath-Jearim. It's safe. It's protected. It even has a priest to look after it. But there's no intercession going on. God is essentially quiet, and he's not accepting sacrifice from them.
Presence is God.
Yeah, his presence is essentially gone. And so they, because they've been under Philistine oppression for so long, finally go back to God, start crying out to God, because things are finally miserable enough for them that, hey, I know, maybe God would be the answer. Samuel spoke, verse 3, Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, if you return to the Lord with all your heart, remove the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him alone, he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. What that tells you is the reason they've been under Philistine oppression all this time is because of their foreign gods. They turned their back on God, God turned his back on them. And so if at any point they had recognized once again what God kept saying, just do things my way, just follow my rules, follow my law, just obey me and worship me the way I say, then it's all going to be fine for you, and I'll make sure you have plenty to eat, and I'll take care of your kids, and your fields won't spoil, and I'll rebuke the devourer for your sake, and I'll run off your enemies, and I'll take care of you. And time again, with each successive generation that comes and goes, there's the generation that lives under God's hand of blessing, and then their kids come along, and their kids have just always kind of had it good, and God's just always kind of been there, and within a generation, they rebel again, and they turn away from God, and then they end up under the hand of their enemies for 40 years, and they're under persecution or some number, 80, 120, usually divisible by 40, and then they end up going back to God, crying out to God, and he delivers them. So this time, it's interesting, in the past, he always sent them a judge. He always sent them a Samson. He always sent them somebody to lead them in battle. This time, Samuel says to them, this is really up to you. You got to change. If you will return to the Lord with all your heart, remove your gods and your Ashtaroth from you. Direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him alone. Then he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. So the sons of Israel removed the Baals and the Ashtaroth and served the Lord alone. Were they doing that, do you think? This is just an interesting question. I read these things and think to myself, were they really doing this out of a heart of love for God? No, probably not. It looks like they were doing it for their own benefit, their own fleshly welfare. This isn't working. What we're doing now is not working. Yes, let's avoid the pain. Let's go back and worship God and see if that'll work for us. So they served the Lord alone. And then Samuel said, gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you. And they gathered to Mizpah, and they drew water, and they poured it out before the Lord, and they fasted on that day. That's an interesting thing that they did. They drew water, which means they had to pull the water up out of the wells, out of the ground. And in a desert area like that, water is a precious commodity, and while they were fasting, they'd pull up water and then pour it out on the ground to show God that they were trusting him for their sustenance. They were trusting him to keep them going, and that even the water that they needed to survive, they would pour out on the dry ground as a sign of worship toward God. And they said, we have sinned against the Lord. And God responded, well, duh. You have to learn to read the white spaces between the... Never mind. Never mind. Even Gladys smiled at that. So, Samuel judged the sons of Israel at Mizpah. Now, when the Philistines heard that the sons of Israel had gathered to Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. And when the sons of Israel heard it, they were afraid of the Philistines. Then the sons of Israel said to Samuel, do not cease to cry to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hand of the Philistines. And Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it for a whole burnt offering to the Lord. And Samuel cried to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. Now Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, and the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel. But the Lord thundered with a great thunder on that day against the Philistines and confused them so that they were routed before Israel. And the men of Israel went out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and struck them down as far as below Beth-kar. Now, of course, this is not the end of the Philistine problem, because you know that at some point they're going to end up at war against the Philistines yet again. And the young man who God is going to choose to be king is going to go out there and fight with Goliath of Gath and is going to say, who is this uncircumcised Philistine? And so the Philistines have been driven back for a while out of their borders. In fact, verse 13 will tell us, well, verse 12 will tell us, Samuel took a stone and set it between Mizpah and Shen, and named it Ebenezer, saying, this far the Lord has helped us. In other words, this is our new border now. We've got our cities back. So the Philistines were subdued, and they did not come anymore within the border of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. And the cities which the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel, from Ekron even to Gath. And Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines, so there was peace between Israel and the Amorites. And then the chapter ends with just a little summation of Samuel's ministry as a judge. It says, now Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, and he used to go annually on a circuit. He was the first circuit rider. He used to go on a circuit to Bethel and Gilgal and Mizpah, and he judged Israel in all these places. Then his return was to Ramah, for his house was there, and there he judged Israel, and he built there an altar to the Lord. And then next week we'll get to it came about when Samuel was old that he appointed his sons to be judges over Israel. And gee, it's all going to get real familiar because his sons are not going to be good judges. And they're going to use that power to enrich themselves. There's going to be an outcry against those boys to Samuel. And that's going to become the basis for which they're going to say, we want a king, just like all the nations around us. All our other nations and neighbors, they all have kings. We want to be like them. Despite the fact that God chose Israel and said, now you're going to be a peculiar nation, which means separate, distinct nation, because you're going to be mine. And so you're not going to be like all the nations around you. You're going to follow after me, follow my rules, my laws. And they're going to say, we don't want that. We want to be like everybody else. We want to be accepted. We don't want to be distinct and unique. We want to fit in with the world. We want a king. And the basis of their argument is going to be, well, your boys, who you set up as judges, when you're gone, what are we going to do? They're no good. We need us a king. So we'll get to that next week, and we will be introduced to God saying just as clearly as he can, if you want human government, it's going to eat up all the good of the land and take all the best of your stuff, and they're going to enrich themselves on your back and make you servants and slaves to them. And nothing's changed in all these years. Yeah. We'll look at that next week, and it will be real hard not to talk political next week. All righty?
All right.
All right. Any questions about that? Lesson number two was not quite as long as number one, and apparently far less confusing. So that's a good thing.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.